Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too. Today, my guest is Dr. Joan Gross. She's a professor of anthropology at Oregon State University. And the field that she studied is linguistic anthropology and cultural anthropology. And she's worked in a lot of different places, Belgium and Latin America. She's worked in North Africa, mainly with French and related languages. But now she's working with food, and that has to do with health. So welcome, Joan.
Thanks for inviting me, Bobby.
Tell me how you got interested in food.
I've been interested in food for a long time, but I haven't really blended it with my academic work until 2004, when I was asked, along with Nancy Rosenberger, to interview rural residents of Benton County to find out what were their problems in accessing good, healthy food. This was at a time right after, I guess it was in 1999, when Oregon came out to have the highest rate of hunger. Yeah, that was quite surprising. And my family has always been food-centered. And when I lived abroad, that was always one of the most interesting things, was getting to know the food cultures of the area and getting to know where to buy things, what were the different things, how people cooked. And certainly living in Morocco 2 years, always cooking seasonally.
It's a great way to meet people, and it's something that people always like to talk about.
And when I came to Oregon, I was really taken with how rich the area was agriculturally. I became pregnant, and in Morocco, you always get a sheepskin for the new baby to lie on. And I saw sheep all over the fields here, so I thought, oh, that shouldn't be any problem at all. And when I started looking around, I couldn't find any place I could get a sheepskin. And I started looking because we'd been used to living on sheep, lamb. I noticed that in the stores, it was all coming from New Zealand. And I couldn't quite understand why the fields were full of sheep, but you couldn't get any
local sheep. Not much in the store.
So that's always intrigued me, you know, why we would have such a rich area and you couldn't get the local stuff in the store. And then we had this high instance of hunger. So then Nancy and I started interviewing rural people and found out a lot of interesting things. There was a lot of community activity. In 2004, there was a food summit downtown. From that, the Ten Rivers Food Web was formed. I've been active in that group since the beginning.
And was Ten Rivers Food Web...
I think we started doing interviews, and then there was the food summit. There was a fishbowl meeting. If I remember correctly, there were five chairs in the middle, and you would go and sit in the chair to report something, but then you would vacate your chair and someone else would come in. So it was a nice way of getting a lot of participation and not having it dominated by one or two people.
Right. And then people sort of sit around the edges of it, I guess, like a bowl, and then they move in and out.
Yeah. And then what happened is after that, some of us started meeting regularly. It was through those regular meetings then that the Ten Rivers Food Web was formed.
And where does 10 come in?
Well, there are 10 rivers. We looked at the food shed. What would constitute our food shed that would also make some sense administratively?
So that's analogous to a watershed.
We wanted a diverse food shed moving from the mountains to the coast, and it fits quite nicely with Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. So we decided to take that three counties looking at the food shed, and in that three counties are 10 rivers. And since water is so important to agriculture and how health, how we live, we decided to take the name of 10 rivers, and we do highlight the names of those 10 rivers on the website.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And the overflow of the rivers, of course, makes a rich agricultural area.
And we're loaded, of course, with microclimates, and no one's better than small farmers at figuring out where those microclimates are.
Have you worked much with the local farmers here?
Through Ten Rivers.
Are they on board with the Ten Rivers activities?
the small farmers, yes, and the other thing I should mention is the South Willamette Valley Bean and Grain Project, of which Ten Rivers is one of the founding members. Mm-hmm. The term that hasn't come up yet, which is very important, is food sovereignty, which every culture should have the right to be able to determine the food that they eat. Mm. So we were thinking, okay, in this area, certainly the staple foods are grains and beans, and grains kind of were phased out of this area. And when they were phased out, the infrastructure dropped out as well. Mm-hmm. So the South Willamette Bean and Grain Project is really encouraging farmers to get back into growing these staples of beans and grains, and at the same time trying to figure out ways of reintroducing the infrastructure. Several farmers have, you know, put together little mills. We had a great Fill Your Pantry event in the fall. Hundreds of people came to buy beans and grains that they could store for the winter. And the production of these staple foods has really gone up in our part of the valley in the last year or two.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And the food co-op has helped in that process.
Yes, it has. Yeah, you can now get Stalford wheat at the co-op and grind it right there yourself to take home.
And that's just, what, about 5-10 miles from town here where it's grown?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Expand beyond the fruits, obviously, that our valley is very good at, and all the vegetables as well. What people constitute the Ten Rivers food web?
Eventually, we'd like every resident in the three-county area to be involved in it. But starting out as an all-volunteer board, it's been, you know, about 15 of us really working hard over the last couple of years. But this last year, we were able to get an AmeriCorps Vista member and through the Oregon Food Bank, two AmeriCorps Rare volunteers. So right now, we're in the process of doing a community food assessment for the three-county area, and that will give us a nice groundwork on which to build to see which directions are the most profitable in the sense of feeding more people.
Feeding more people and feeding them better. You know, we have some very nice food markets here in town. We have Saturday market. We have a Wednesday market.
We just sponsored a holiday local food market on Terra Madre Day. We did that in combination with Slow Food Corvallis. Terra Madre is an international day of really looking at biodiversity in the global food web and the plight of small farmers and eating well and all of that. So there were events all around the world on Friday, December 10th.
We had this process of selling coupons to provide food to people in the poverty range or above. That hasn't worked too well, and I know there's been a lot of discussion about what the barriers are to people using our Saturday markets, our farmers markets. Have you worked at all with
that? I'm real glad you brought that up, because the program that you're talking about is That's My Farmer.
That's My Farmer, yes, that's the name of it.
And it was started by the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. And it is a great program. You know, there's no differentiation of the coupons that people would buy. You buy a coupon booklet for $20, you get $18 worth of coupons. And with the extra $2, coupons are bought through different congregations and given to low-income parishioners, but also in emergency food pantries and things like that. But the return rate, I think this is
what you were referring to,
was very poor for the low-income coupons being cashed in.
There's concern about why those aren't being used and whether it's a matter of the transportation aspect getting to the farmers markets. On Saturday, they're down by the river and fairly easy to get to by bus for most people.
That's exactly the problem that Ten Rivers is going to be working on this year.
Oh.
The whole That's My Farmer program. What we're talking about is expanding it, first of all, because right now it's been really located in Corvallis. We would like to expand it through Linn and Lincoln counties. And we'd like to do so through the Farmers Market Incentive Program. This past year, there's been a program where people who are using their Oregon Trail or EBT cards at the farmers market get a matching up to $6 extra at the farmers market. And this past year, we've only been able to do it thanks to Benton County Health Department in Corvallis. But we would like to do that in all of the farmers markets. So we have people who are interested at the Newport Market and the Sweet Home, Brownsville, and certainly Albany, to start to fold the That's My Farmer into this incentive program at the farmers market, because there's no leakage. If whoever comes to the market will get that. There won't be coupon booklets floating out there that aren't cashed in. So that's one part of it, is sort of expanding it and hooking it in to the farmers markets.
So people would come to the markets and that's where they would get the coupon books and that's where they would use it.
Well, we're hoping that we can continue selling them through congregations.
Oh, sure.
That what we would be selling rather than a coupon booklet is a certificate for farmers market tokens.
The tokens are redeemed
exactly
at the market.
Right.
And that would be the strategy to get
yes.
past this problem that some of them just haven't been used.
With our three AmeriCorps people, we're hoping we'd sell them at rural grocery stores and different places.
Mm-hmm.
So the person who would buy the certificate would then redeem that for
okay.
tokens at the farmers market.
Mm-hmm.
And the extra $2 would go into the pool of money that's used to match the incentive program for people who are using EBT cards at the farmers markets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And most of the vendors accept them, don't they?
That would be another difference. That's My Farmer targeted just a few farmers, and this would be open to all farmers at the farmers markets.
Mm.
The other part of it is to address why the other program had such a low rate of people cashing it in. And that's, as you know, as an anthropologist, is a cultural thing.
A cultural thing.
I think that we need to work on. And in some people's minds is the farmers market being marked as a middle class place.
It's interesting because in the old days, I mean, I'm thinking back to my childhood, and I grew up in an area that had a lot of Amish farmers, northeastern Indiana, and we had farmers market stalls downtown, and I wasn't middle class, but
no.
it was great. People
no,
really liked
actually,
it.
Actually, when I grew up, Bobby, you went to the farmers market to get lower prices on
exactly.
things.
So it's a cultural thing that it's felt that it is kind of a middle class thing. And on a Saturday morning, there is entertainment at the farmers markets too. And so if a person has time to spend, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
If you are really busy or you have a lot of small children, it's probably a lot more difficult to manage.
It's good that you brought up the idea of time, because if you're stuck doing minimum wage jobs, and maybe two of them, you don't have a lot of time. And when you have time, you don't have any energy.
There is a hour or 2 hour farmers market at one of our public housing units.
I haven't gotten statistics on that market yet, but I was very excited that it had happened. There are also several CSAs. CSA is community supported agriculture. The traditional way is that you pay a fairly substantial amount in the spring when farmers need the money to buy seeds. And then you get, once the growing season begins, you get a weekly box of food. And then in the fall, the farmers have their harvest money.
So it works well for the farmer and for the consumer. And
yes.
oftentimes they bring the boxes pretty close to where you live.
A central place. It still tends to be a more middle class practice, but some farmers have figured out how to use the EBT card, the electronic benefits transfer card, the Oregon Trail card in this state, and not to do it at one payment in the spring, but to do it as you go. So that's made it more available to lower income people. And then other farmers have just done a kind of buying club where they let people know what they have. And there are certain small farmers who will actually deliver it directly to your house, especially if you order like maybe $10 or more, that they'll come right to your house and deliver, which is interesting because that's the way my mother grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, that they had farmers that her family had a relationship with, and the farmers came every week and dropped off vegetables.
I remember the butter and egg man, and he sold chickens too, who came to our neighborhood. Of course, we didn't realize how convenient it was until we didn't have it.
Right.
Well, I've got to ask you something that I've kind of noticed. I haven't been in the midst of this. We used to talk about hunger and malnutrition a lot, and now what is food insecurity? It has just hit me as a cliche. I have to say that it really has been taken as a mantra almost. How did that happen, and is it an okay word now? Has it been absorbed into the culture enough that we know what it means?
Well, you know, terminology is always chosen at some point and gets expanded. And food insecurity, I don't know if this is the origin of it, but certainly the source of the expansion of it is with the USDA survey on whether people have enough to eat. Mm. And so they ranked categories, and one was whether you were food secure or whether you were food insecure. Was there any time over the last 12 months where you didn't know where your next meal was coming from? I'd like to check on that. It's something like that. It's just the idea that people don't always know that they're going to have enough to eat. And so that's the most general food insecurity thing. And then there was food insecurity with hunger, which was another category where, you know, you actually skipped meals, you were actually hungry, your children were hungry, and that was to mark the low end of that. And then in the last year or so, they got rid of hunger with one fell swoop by just getting rid of the term and calling it very low food insecurity.
So it's a gradation.
Yeah. Now. And I think that was probably a bad move just because hunger has so much emotional weight.
Exactly.
And very low food insecurity sounds very much like government speak.
Exactly. Yeah. And one could be food insecure, even very food insecure, and still be obese, I suppose.
Yes,
right?
That's absolutely true. What we found interviewing in rural Benton County was that there were a lot of people who had something to eat, but it wasn't the food they wanted to eat. And they often knew that, you know, they should be eating more fruits and vegetables. So it wasn't a matter of ignorance, but they just couldn't afford it. Because as you go into looking at food insecurity, you can't get away from just poverty, and everything comes to bear on that. A lot of people we interviewed were actually had middle-class jobs, and then for some reason they had a health crisis and then couldn't work. And when they couldn't work, they lost their health insurance and found themselves very quickly in poverty. The housing costs are very high in this area.
They are.
And food is a flexible expense. You can't reduce the amount of your mortgage payment or a lot of other things, but you can reduce the amount you pay on food. And Americans, I think, have been well trained to spend less on food. We do spend less on food than any other first world country.
Maybe this relates to the global or at least international problem of factory farms, huge farms that are trying to make as much food as possible with as little labor and as little attention paid to nature. And so we think we should have as much food as we need for a very small amount of money, relatively speaking. And today, meat can be bought very cheaply, and it's the really good fruits and vegetables frequently that you do have to pay for. And yet, as we've learned over the years, those are the things you really, really, really need.
But I think there's still in the American mentality the idea that it is okay to spend a lot for meat, but it's not really okay to spend a lot for fruits and vegetables.
And another thing maybe we should talk about is seasonality.
Yes.
What do you think about that, seasonality?
Well, I think that as Americans have gotten disconnected from their sources of food, they've gotten way disconnected from seasonality. And as the global industrial food system has taken up the slack and we can get anything at any time of the year, it distances us further from our own environment and what is available when. So I think that is something that has to be re-educated into Americans to try to work with the seasons, at least know when things are in seasons. And then, and it makes the year a more interesting place where you're looking forward to when the new apples are in, when you can harvest something, when, you know, strawberries are in season, and not, oh, I just want to eat strawberries in December and go to the store. And you get something that looks like a strawberry, but it doesn't exactly taste like a strawberry.
Eating them out of season entices people to put sauces on them, but if it were in season, it might have enough sweetness on its own.
Interesting that you should bring up the matter of taste, because that is also something that we've been looking at in food studies. There's much more interest in how is taste developed and what has happened with populations that have gotten so focused on fat, sugar, and not having that broad palate of being interested in other kinds of taste. Standard American palate has gotten shrunk over the years.
And even at the same time as we tend to have more restaurants that specialize in like Mediterranean cuisine or Middle Eastern, or of course always Asian is very popular of various sorts.
But it's that focus on the fats and sugars, the more unhealthy processed food, because I think a lot of the food insecure people are not going to the ethnic restaurants the way the middle classes are.
Another thing we need to talk about is to relate all of this to general health. We've talked a little bit about obesity, but what other health problems do you think you can consider with not eating local healthy food?
I know there's a lot of research now done on micronutrients and how fruits and vegetables that are grown organically, where people really tend to the soil, are much richer in those micronutrients. Now, I do think that we just don't have it all figured out now. I mean, if you look at nutrition, you know, you've got to eat this, this vitamin is good, that, no, don't do this, you know, and it changes quite often. I can see that people would not have a whole lot of trust in that. But, I mean, we can trust what human societies have done over the years and the diversity of food and eating food that's fresh.
You've referred to the slow food movement.
When McDonald's opened up a restaurant on the Spanish Steps in Rome in 1986, and Carlo Petrini, who was a left-wing journalist from the north of Italy, said, you know, that's enough. We've got to start a slow food movement. In 1989, he put forth a manifesto that was signed by 15 different countries. I don't know who in those countries signed it, but since then, the movement has really been growing. It's over 100,000 people globally now. I had the pleasure of attending the last Terra Madre event in October in Italy, and they had representatives of 161 different countries there.
Oh, my goodness. That's wonderful.
He called it the United Nations of Peasants.
Who were all these people?
Well, small farmers, fishermen, also food activists and food educators. And a lot of young people, a lot of women farmers, a lot of young farmers.
You know, people for a long time have been afraid that they couldn't make a successful operation on a small farm. And so that sets up the process of buying out the neighbors or else waiting to be bought out yourself, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, it is a hard way to make a living because the prices of food are
volatile.
Yeah.
And the weather.
And pests and disease. And then people not understanding all of the work that goes into doing good natural food. Michael Bell has done some interesting work on farming in the Midwest. I think he started off one of his books of talking about a farmer's meeting in Iowa, where the farmer starts it out by saying, so what do you want, your neighbor or your neighbor's farm? Well, one thing that we're doing here in Corvallis now is doing tasting tables through Slow Food Corvallis and the Corvallis Environmental Center. They have farmers go into the elementary schools with a particular product of the month, like watermelon, but even onions. And I must say that once I was in Rainbow Grocery, and there was a little boy with his mom in there, and he said, Mom, why don't you get some onions? And she said, you know, you don't like onions. He said, I do now because I had them at the tasting table.
Wow.
I thought, oh, boy. You know, ethnographers love to hear these little comments on the side when you're not actually asking people to evaluate something, but just to hear it in the grocery store.
You know, it's real.
Great. I wanted to tell you, when I was last summer, I was in Belgium in farming country and went to a frozen food factory. And I was very impressed by how high tech it was in tracking the exact field that the food came from, even in the final package, where you'd have a package of frozen peas, it would be barcoded from the exact field that it came from. And that came right after our scare with E. coli on spinach, and nobody could figure out where it came from. And and I could really see the difference in what they were doing in Europe versus what they were doing in the U.S.
That would be really something, wouldn't it? And it would be also nice for the consumer, who could decide whether he wanted to buy it from such a place. Now, I think a lot of our products say made in the USA or not. And then it's a pretty broad category there.
Right. And the other thing that often happens when third world farmers are encouraged to grow for export is that their own food sovereignty and their own food security goes out the window. There's a good book done on Guatemalan farmers who've been encouraged to grow broccoli because they can grow broccoli year-round for the American market. They don't like broccoli, and by planting broccoli, they don't plant their corn, beans, and squash, and people have a hard time, you know, getting enough to eat. They push people more into a cash economy and away from ways that they've been able to subsist and feed themselves for centuries.
The diversity of their cuisine must just really suffer. I mean, it's just like a factory almost.
And they feel like they're richer because they have cash and they can go into the city and they can buy snack foods and processed foods, and those become high status foods, but they're not as nutritious as the foods that they used to grow. There is a real re-interest in these things, though, as you said, and a lot of the young people, like on campus, there I have a lot of students who are really interested in food studies, and we're trying to cater to that on campus by starting a new initiative in food and culture in the humanities and social science. And we have, on the other side of campus, we have food science, nutrition, and the School of Ag. We have a lot of interest in looking at, so how do people think about food, and how do food systems work? And a lot of research these days that young people are very interested in.
It's wonderful that there's an outlet for that, that people want to know those things. Well, this has been a very interesting talk, and
thank you. That's been very nice talking with you, Bobby.
Thank you. This has been a conversation with Dr. Joan Gross of the Anthropology Department at OSU on the Health and Healthcare Forum. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording in Corvallis, Oregon. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers in Kent White.